Last week we saw the transition of power from the first king of Israel, Saul, to the second king of Israel, David. We saw a number of political moves that David took. They were political, but they were really based on his relationship with God, and that is dealing with the kindness that he had towards Saul's family, and not the typical elimination and assassination of all the people that had been loyal to his predecessor that you would find typically in that kind of society and in that type of kingship. We also saw some other political moves that he did. He had started out being named king of the southern tribe of Judah, but then eventually he also became named the king of all of Israel. So he moved his headquarters from Hebron, which is inside Judah, to Jerusalem. He conquered Jerusalem, which happened to be a city on the border of Judah and Benjamin, that is the southern tribe of Judah and the border to the northern tribes. And it was basically no man's land. Neither tribe really claimed it, so it was a neutral location, perfect location to set up a national political capital. He also then, we saw, move the ark there and set up a tent of tabernacle for God. And so he also made Jerusalem the religious capital. So everything was focused then on Jerusalem. It was also called the City of David there in Jerusalem. Today we're going to go further in the story, continuing on. We left off in 2 Samuel chapter 7, so we'll go chapters 8 through 12 today and talk about basically about how he brought peace to Israel. And we saw during the reign of Saul there was constant battles, and Saul had trouble on every direction, north, south, east, and west. The biggest part of his trouble was west, the Philistines. And we'll see how David brought peace to that situation and brought peace to Israel and set the stage for the third king, the man of peace, Solomon, which his name even means peace, Shalom. Let's go on. Give us a little background. If we take a look, let's take a look first at the first big enemy, the one that I mentioned that's on the west side, the Philistines. They were along the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea. Israel had settled in the mountains and the foothills, but the coastal plains right there along the Mediterranean Sea, they never did conquer that land, and that people that was there from the time of Joshua continued to get stronger and stronger and stronger, and they were the ones that we saw at the end of the book of Judges that was giving Israel so much trouble, and it was the biggest enemy that Saul had to contend with, and that's the Philistines, and that's the western neighbor of Israel. So back when Saul was king, and David was being chased by Saul out of jealousy, where did David find safety when Saul was trying to kill him? If we turn to 1 Samuel 27, we see that. Verse 1, but David thought to himself, one of these days I'll be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I'll slip out of his hand. So David and the 600 men with him left and went over to Achish, son of Maoch, king of Gath. Gath is one of the big five cities of the Philistines. When Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, he no longer searched for him. Okay? David's in Philistine territory. There's no way Saul could just go in and try to get him. There's no way that Saul could even just ask the Philistines to turn him over. Why not? Again, if you look at 14 verse 52... it says that all the days of Saul there was bitter war with the Philistines. Okay, so he did not have any good relations with the Philistines to be able to ask them to turn over a fugitive. And the Philistines, hey, if David's an enemy of Saul, he's a friend of mine. And we saw that friendship form between David and Achish, the king of Gath. So much so that, for instance, take a look at verse 12 of chapter 27. It says, Achish trusted David and said to himself, he's become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he may be my servant forever. And part of what added to that is what we see in the previous verses there of chapter 27, where David and his men, well, earlier in the chapter we see that Achish gave David a town, Ziklag, and that became David's town there in the Philistine area, and he and his men lived there rather than staying in Gath. And from there, they would make regular raiding parties where they would go out and conquer cities and towns and peoples. They would do so of the people south of Philistia, the Geshurites and Gerzites and the Amalekites that were further south there. But when they would come back from the raiding parties, Achish would say, "Hey, where'd you go?" They say, "Oh, we went and raided some of the towns of Judah." Okay, some of the Israelite towns. So Achish, you see his response here in this verse. He said, well, he's not just an enemy of Saul, he's an enemy of the Israelites. And therefore, Achish trusted him. So much so that we see in chapter 29, when the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, and Israel camped by the spring in Jezreel, as the Philistine rulers marched with their hundreds and thousands, David and his men were marching at the rear with Achish. Okay, so the trust was so much there, and you see that at the beginning of chapter 28. And you know, when the Philistines gathered their forces, Achish said to David, "You must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army." David said, "Oh, then you'll see for yourself what your servant can do." Achish replied, "Well, very well." So Achish trusted him so much that when they went to battle with the Israelites, he not only invited David and his men to come fight with him, but he said, "You've got to. Okay, this is part of your responsibility of seeking refuge in my country." And David said, "Then you'll get to see what I can do." It's kind of a double sounding, and it is a double meaning kind of response that David has there. Achish took that to see, oh, David's going to prove himself to me even greater. Well, David took it to show, you'll see the hand of God at work with my men as we side with the Israelites. So David and his men went along, but as they got to the point of battle, got to the place where the army was gathering, the other Philistine commanders didn't like that. Verses 4 to 5 say, you got to send this guy back. We don't trust him. He's already killed tons of Philistines. We don't trust him. And so Achish in verse 6 said to David, "As surely as the Lord, as your God Yahweh lives, you've been reliable, and I would be pleased to have you serve with me in the army. From the day that you came to me until now, I found no fault in you, but the rulers don't approve of you." And in verse 9, he said, "The Philistine commanders have said, you must not go into battle with us, so you need to go back." So Achish, the one that knew David, trusted him, but the other kings didn't. So you see, his relationship with the Philistines, or at least with Achish, the king of Gath, was very strong. Now later, then when he became king of not just Judah, but king of Israel, did that translate into an ally relationship and a friendship relationship with the Philistines? 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 17 says that when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in force to search for him, in full force to search for him. But David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. And then verse 22, once more the Philistines came up and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So we see that twice the Philistines went out and attacked Israel when they heard that David had become king. So even though there had been some relationship there, some friendship between David and Achish, and some trusting there, when David became king, he's now the leader of their greatest enemy. You know, the Israelites were the Philistines' greatest enemy. And you look at it from the Philistine perspective, they had no neighbors on their west. That was the coast. They had down to the south was really nothing. That's all desert land. Nobody wants that land. To the north, you had some neighbors there. But really, the biggest border that they had, the biggest boundary that they had, that if they wanted to grow, that's what they had to extend, that was to their east. And who was there? Israel. So now David is the king of that enemy nation, and so they seek out David to get rid of him. And they know about his strength. They know all about David, so they need to get rid of him early before he can have victory over them. He's a military man. He fights battles all the time. He's quite a soldier and has a lot of loyal soldiers. So they felt that they needed to take care of him and get him out of the picture. So how did David react to these actions? Well, if we look at the verses in between there, David inquired, after the first time that the Philistines came, David inquired of Yahweh and said, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" You know, again, it looks obvious. If Philistines are attacking, it's obvious that you as king should respond, okay, and go fight them. But David inquires of God, okay? And this is showing the heart of David. This is showing that David is a man after God's heart. David is a model of faithfulness for us. And he always, even when it appears obvious to him in human concepts, that he always turns to God and inquires of God and looks for God's will in situations. So the Lord answered him, "Go, for I will surely hand the Philistines over to you." So David went to Baal-perazim, and there he defeated them. He said, "As waters break out, the Lord has broken out against my enemies before me." And that's why the name is called Baal-perazim, which means the Lord who breaks out. Okay. And then the second time the Philistines came, verse 23, so David inquired of Yahweh again. Okay, and this time he answered, "Do not go straight up, but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the balsam trees." Now 24 is really neat. It says, "As soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, move quickly, because that will mean that Yahweh has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army." So David did as Yahweh commanded him. He struck down all the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer. So we see that David both times looked to God for guidance. He followed God's direction, did what God told him to do, and he received God's victories. It's not that David had the victory, it's that God had the victory and David received that. Okay, you see the Lord's army marching out before him. That's his relationship with the Philistines. So we see this battle early in his reign with the Philistines. Does he have warfare and with the Philistines all the rest of his reign like Saul did? Well, that gets us into our first chapter today, chapter 8, verse 1. "In the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And he took Metheg Amma from the control of the Philistines," which we have no idea what Metheg Amma was, but what town that was, but apparently it was important back then. So David subdued the Philistines. And so during his reign, they stopped being a problem. They were such a major problem during Saul's reign. But if you remember, the reason Saul had so much trouble was because of his unfaithfulness. That was part of God's discipline, God's judgment against Saul. But David, instead, as the faithful king, God gave him victory. And he was able to subdue his greatest enemy. And then we go on in chapter 8, and that's really what chapter 8 is about David's relationships and David's bringing peace to Israel from all the enemies around them. Okay, so now we've got the west side taken care of, the Philistines. What about, let's just start looking at them. We'll go in the order that chapter 8 brings them. The next one we hear about is the Moabites. And just as we saw with the Philistines, David, before he became king, had a special relationship with the Philistines. What about with the Moabites? What kind of special relationship did he have there? Well, if you go back to the book of Ruth, if you look at verse 22 of chapter 1, you get Naomi returned from Moab. So we've got this story of Ruth where Naomi and her family had moved to Moab during a time of famine. And when she came back, she was accompanied by her daughter-in-law, Ruth, who was from Moab, who was a Moabitess. Okay? And they came to Bethlehem, and then you've got this story where Ruth eventually gets married to a wealthy Israelite there in Bethlehem named Boaz. And in chapter 4, verse 13, we see that Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and Yahweh enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Okay, so what does all this have to do with David? Well, verse 17 says that the women living there said, "Naomi has a son," Naomi being the grandmother of this child, "and they named him Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David." Okay, so what is it saying? David's great-grandmother was a Moabitess, was from Moab. Okay, so we have a relationship there with the Moabites. Okay, well, that's four generations removed, right? Something like that, or three generations. Does that have any impact on David? Well, if you look at 1 Samuel chapter 22, when Saul was pursuing David, chasing David around, and it was obvious to David that Saul would do anything he could to get to David, well, what's one of the things you're concerned about? You get very concerned about your family. And so we see in chapter 22, verse 3, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, "Would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. So Moab was a place of refuge for David's parents while he was running around from Saul, while Saul was trying to kill David. And the king of Moab protected David. So there was a good relationship between David and the Moabites. So, did that continue on once David became king? Was there a friendly relationship, an alliance there between Moab and Israel once David became king? Verse 2 of chapter 8, David also defeated the Moabites. Okay, so apparently they must have attacked. There was something that there was a battle. There was fighting between the Moabites and Israel after David became king. Now, what's interesting is the severe reaction that he has, which kind of tells us that, you know, it was an attack by Moab. It says, "He made the Moabites lie down on the ground and measured them off with a length of cord. Every two lengths of them were put to death, and the third length was allowed to live." So the Moabites then became subject to David and brought tribute. So he conquered and subdued the Moabites. Now, be aware, and you'll see this from now through, for the rest of the time that we talk about the kings of Israel. A conquering nation, a nation that was more powerful than others, when they would conquer another nation, sometimes they would gobble them up into their own empire, but most often they would leave that nation there but keep them weak enough to where they would not be able to stand up against them and create any problems for them. And that was called being subject to them or being a vassal of them. And part of what they did to keep them weak, well, they obviously would put outposts and garrisons and, you know, put some of their military force out there. They would conscript their people to become slaves or servants and make sure that they didn't get enough strength there as far as soldier kind of manpower. But they would also require an annual tribute that every year that vassal nation would have to bring some great wealth, some great gift, some great payment. You can call it protection money, whatever, that would help make the conquering nation, the master nation, stronger and the other nation weaker. And so that's what we have with the Moabites here, that they were subject to David and brought tribute. Tribute is that protection payment that I mentioned. Okay, let's go on. So that takes care. Now the Moab was kind of, Moab was south, east, actually kind of east and then south. If you go across the Jordan River, okay, which Israel was there, south of that, south of the people on the east side of the Jordan River is where Moab was. Moab was on the east side of the Salt Sea, of the Dead Sea. Okay? Moab was an area that Israel would never conquer because that was God's gift to the Moabites who were descendants of Lot. Okay? But there were various times where the Moabites and the Israelites got along, usually not very often. Usually they were enemies and created problems a lot. But here we see David brought some peace with the Moabites. All right, let's go on. North of Israel and north of the Philistines was an area called Zobah. So what about the Zobahites? Okay. What kind of relationship did Israel have with Zobah, its northern neighbor? Go back to 1 Samuel 14, verse 47. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. Moab, which we saw where that is, on the east and south. The Ammonites, which is on the east. Edom, which is to the south. The kings of Zobah, which is to the north. And the Philistines, which is to the west. The point of that verse is that he had enemies on every side of him, Zobah being one of those. So we get to David's time. Did the relations between Zobah and Israel improve when David became king? Chapter 8, verse 3. Moreover, David fought Hadadezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah, when he went to restore his control along the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, and 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. So you see, you haven't heard much of Zobah. I haven't either. But they obviously had a pretty strong army at this time when David took control. But yet he was able to conquer them and pretty much decimated their army. God gave David a great victory. How else did God bless David through this victory against Zobah? Verse 7. David took the gold shields that belonged to the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. From Teba and Berothai, towns that belonged to Hadadezer, King David took a great quantity of bronze. So there's a lot of bronze and gold spoils, very valuable spoils that enriched Israel and enriched David's kingdom through this. Now, there's a special way that these were later used. If we turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 8, we see from Teba and Kun, towns that belonged to Hadadezer, David took a great quantity of bronze, which Solomon used to make the bronze sea, the pillars, and various bronze articles. Okay, these are, the bronze sea was this big, huge, huge bronze bowl at the temple that out in front of the altar that was filled with water, and it was called the sea. And so that bronze that was used to make it was from this battle here. Some pillars and various bronze articles. So all of that was committed to God's service. That was committed for use in building the articles of the temple, the spoils of this. So again, you see that David, you see his faith. Okay, he could claim all this for himself. He could claim all this great wealth. But instead, he dedicated it to God here. Alright, so that's Zobah. Now next to Zobah, kind of to the east of Zobah and to the north of Zobah, as you keep going on northeast towards, which is really where the good land is, and towards the Euphrates River, the next that you get to is Syria, or in those days called Aram, A-R-A-M. So what kind of relationship did Israel have with Aram, the nation to the north of Zobah? Chapter 8, verse 5. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, okay, because obviously if your neighbor to the south is being attacked by his neighbor to the south, who's next in line? You are. So they went and helped. The Arameans went and helped the Zobahites. But David struck down 22,000 of them. Okay, so we had an animosity. We had an enemy relationship between Aram and Israel, but God gave Israel the victory here. How else did God bless David through victory against Aram? Verse 6, he put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus. Okay, so he put outposts and garrisons so that he would have people, military people there all the time to keep the nation under his control. And the Arameans became subject to him and brought tribute. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. So we have the Arameans becoming subject and Israel receiving tribute from the Arameans as a result of this battle as well. And that key verse there, God gave David victory wherever he went. Okay, why? Because he was faithful. He was a man after God's heart. All right, next. Well, there's actually another, if you keep going past Aram, before you get to the Euphrates River, because that's quite a ways away, the next town you get, or next country you get to is Hamath. So what about Hamath? What kind of relationship did Israel have with Hamath? Verses 9 and 10. When Tal, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, he sent his son Joram to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory in battle over Hadadezer, who had been at war with Tal. Joram brought with him articles of silver and gold and bronze. Okay, so what kind of relationship did they have? They formed allies there. Okay, David was not out for building an empire and out for offensive, aggressive, attacking others to try to claim territory. Rather, David was seeking peace for his nation. And so he didn't have peace from Zobah, he didn't have peace from the Philistines, he didn't have peace from the Arameans. Those are the ones who attacked him. When someone attacked him, when someone was an enemy, he brought peace. Now, for the Hamath people, they were afraid of the Israelites, naturally. That's kind of the next, you know, if you're thinking that they're marching on to gather up territory, you'd be afraid. And so they sent words of peace and also words of congratulations. But on the other side of it, they were enemies against the Arameans, so they were thrilled to see that the Arameans had been conquered. So we have an alliance there between Israel. So Hamath does not become subject to Israel. They become an ally. All right, that's the north side. What about the south side? Okay, if you go back to 1 Samuel 14, verse 47, you see that on the south side, Edom. Edom was directly south. We saw Moab is south of the part of Israel that's on the east side of the Jordan River. But Edom is south of the part that's on the west side. Edom is south of the Dead Sea and kind of wraps around there a little bit. You get a lot of desert there too. But what about with Edom? What kind of relationship did Israel have with Edom? Well, during Saul's reign, we see in 1 Samuel 14, 47, that they were enemies at that time. What about during David? Verses 13. And David became famous after he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons throughout Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David. And again, we see that the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. So the Edomites were enemies. The Edomites were a problem. So he brought peace by conquering the Edomites, making the Edomites subject to Israel. And again, Yahweh gave David victory wherever he went. So all these victories, we now see that David had peace on every side. He had peace to the west against the Philistines. He had peace to the north with the Zobahites and the Syrians, the Arameans, and with the Hamathites. Okay, so all of those, first two were subject to Israel now. The other was an ally. On the east side, we see that he had peace. Well, we haven't talked about east yet, have we? We've talked about southeast, which was Moab. We've talked about the south. He's got peace now on the south with Edom. We also have the east side, and we'll talk about that in just a second. Before we talk about that, what about all these victories? You know, we saw that when Saul had victories, he would make monuments to himself, and he would take credit, and he got jealous when David got more credit than he got for victories. What about David? How did he respond to these victories? Verse 11, King David dedicated these articles to the Lord, as he had done with the silver and the gold from all the nations that he had subdued. Edom and Moab, the Ammonites and the Philistines and Amalek. He also dedicated the plunder taken from Hadadezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah. So how did David react to the credit for his victories? He didn't. He gave credit to God. He dedicated the plunder to God. So you see, again, a man after God's heart. How was David viewed as a king? Verse 15, David reigned over all of Israel, doing what was just and right for all of his people. So he was viewed as a just king, as a right king, doing what is just and right for his people. And he was, because he was a faithful king. He followed God, and as a result, he was a just and right king. The next verses, we see who some of his leaders were. A few key ones. One that you're going to hear a lot about is Joab, son of Zeruiah. He was the army commander, and you'll see a lot about Joab. We saw about Joab last week when we saw that Joab killed Abner, the commander of Saul's army. We'll see more about Joab as we keep going. He's the secretary of state or the commander of the army, the top general. Now you then have Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was a recorder, and Zadok, son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Sariah was secretary. Benaiah of Jehoiada was over the Kethorites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were royal advisors. A couple others that you see in that list. You see who the high priests were. Zadok and Abiathar were high priests. We see that his sons were advisors. One other that you'll probably see again is Benaiah, who was he was over his special royal guard. Okay, and you'll see that as we get into a story later on about in a future study on that. Okay, that's chapter 8. Chapter 9 we looked at last week with the story of David and Mephibosheth. David showing the love to Saul's family and Jonathan's family, especially in taking Mephibosheth, Jonathan's only son, in under his wings. And so we looked at that last week. Chapter 10, then, we then talk about that other enemy, the one on the east side. Okay, we've had the west with the Philistines had been the big one. Now, probably the next biggest one would be the one on the east side, and that's the Ammonites. Okay, they're on the eastern side of the Israelites. The Ammonites also was a territory that God prevented Israel from attacking, Israel from doing anything against, because the Ammonites also were descendants of Lot. Lot's two children were Moab and Ammon, and so the Ammonites were descendants of Lot, and God gave that territory to them. So, what kind of relationship did Israel have with Ammon, its eastern neighbor? Chapter 10. In the course of time, the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanan succeeded him as king. David thought, I will show kindness to Hanan, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanan concerning his father. So we see that at the beginning of David's rule, his relationship with Ammon was very positive. They had an alliance. They had a friendship between he and the king of the Ammonites, Nahash. But Nahash eventually died, and his son took over. And so when that happened, David sent a delegation to express sympathy to Hanan and to basically pave the way for continued positive relations. Okay? So did Hanan continue the friendly relationships with Israel that his father had begun? Verse 3. When David's men came to the land of the Ammonite nobles said to Hanan their lord, do you think David's honoring your father by sending men to you to express sympathy? Hasn't David sent them to explore the city and to spy it out and overthrow it? Hey, these guys are spies. These guys aren't here to make peace with you. They want to come and destroy you. So Hanan seized David's men, shaved off half of each man's beard. Okay, this is like left and right kind of thing. Cut off their garments in the middle at the buttocks and sent them away. What is he doing here? This is kicking the hornet's nest, right? He's denigrating, he's degrading, he's offending these emissaries. He accused them of spying, and one of the most despicable things that in those days that you could do is just have your beard shaved off. Nobody ever would shave their beard off except for during times of mourning, okay, because you're degrading yourself during that mourning time. Here, he degraded them, and we see this practice elsewhere. We see it in Isaiah that they would cut off their robes at their buttocks, at their butt, so that it would be exposed as they walked. And so, again, humiliating these people and sending them back. Oh, what is he expecting to accomplish with this? He's obviously saying, no, you're not my friends. Well, how does David respond to this? Does he respond by sending his army by force? Verse 5. When David was told about this, he sent messengers to meet the men, for they were greatly humiliated. The king said, stay at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then come back. So what was David's concern? His concern, sure, the Ammonites are provoking him and causing some concern, but you know, God's in control of this. He's more so concerned about his men, about the humiliation that his men were experiencing. And so he said, y'all, don't come back. Wait till your beards grow out, and then you can come back. And he didn't make them come back and be seen by others in this degraded state. Okay, how did this relationship become even more strained? Verse 6. When the Ammonites realized that they had become a stench in David's nostrils, well, duh, what do you think was going to happen here? They hired 20,000 Aramean foot soldiers from Beth Rehob and Zobah. Okay, those are both places that Israel's already conquered, right? As well as the king of Maacah with 1,000 men and 12,000 men from Tob. All of those are places that Israel had already conquered. So he hired a bunch of mercenaries to come and fight for him against Israel. On hearing this, David sent Joab out with the entire army of fighting men. Okay? You see that David waited for Ammon to show their intentions before he reacted to Ammon. Okay? Yes, you have kicked the hornet's nest. You have become a stench in my nostrils. But I'm not here to react when I'm offended. I'm here to bring peace to my country. But then, when they bring all these thousands of mercenaries in, okay, now you're threatening. Now you're threatening my country. And so now I have to defend my country. So he sends Joab and the army out to defend. So what happens when the Israelite army goes out against the Ammonite threat? Verse 8. The Ammonites came out and drew up in battle formation at the entrance to their city gate, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rahob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. Joab saw that there were battle lines in front of him and behind him, so he selected some of the best troops in Israel and deployed them against the Arameans. Okay, that's all the mercenaries from Syria and Zobah, etc. He put the rest of the men under the command of Abishai, his brother. Okay, and so you had these two brothers, and so Abishai was kind of his second in command, and deployed them against the Ammonites. Okay, so he was surrounded on both sides, so he divided his army in half, and he took the half and went against the Arameans and sent the others with his brother against the city, against the Ammonites. Joab said, "If the Arameans are too strong for me, then you are to come to my rescue, but if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I'll come to rescue you. Be strong, let's fight bravely for our people and for the cities of our God. Yahweh will do what is good in his sight." So you see, and you'll see that Joab has, well, we saw his lack of discernment, or he let revenge get the better of him last week when we talked about his killing Abner. But you see that this faithfulness of David kind of rubs off on him, and he says, okay, we got to make our plans, we got to do what's right, but God's going to decide this. Okay, he was trusting God to decide that. But you see, he had a battle plan. They were surrounded. He split the troops and he made a battle plan. So how did the battle turn out? Verse 13. Then Joab and the troops with him advanced to fight the Arameans, and they fled before him. So the Arameans ran into the city. When the Arameans, they ran away. Okay, they retreated. When the Ammonites saw that the Arameans were fleeing, they fled before Abishai and went inside the city. So Joab returned from fighting the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. Okay, so he started to fight these men, and they just ran away. Okay, all the mercenaries, they ran away. And then the Ammonites saw that the people they had hired hadn't held their ground, so they retreated back into the city and fortified it and got in there. Again, what was the purpose here? The purpose was not to conquer Ammon. The purpose is to defend Israel. So when it looked like we had won this war, the Israelites had won this war, Joab just went back. Okay, it wasn't a matter of destroying the city or conquering the city. It was a matter of showing who's in control here and defending the security of Israel. Well, what happens, though, is those armies then regroup. Verse 15. After the Arameans saw that they had been routed by Israel, they regrouped. Hadadezer had Arameans brought from beyond the river, so he recruited even more Arameans from on the other side of the Euphrates. So, trying to find mercenaries anywhere he can. They went to Helam with Shobach, the commander of Hadadezer's army, leading them. When David was told of this, he gathered all of Israel, crossed the Jordan, and went to Helam. The Arameans formed their battle lines to meet David and fought against him. But they fled before Israel, and David killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers. He also struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings who were vassals of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with the Israelites and became subject to them. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore. Okay, so the Arameans regrouped, they brought in more soldiers, they fought, and David had a great victory and decimated their army. And so the Arameans decided, well, it's not worth being mercenaries anymore to the Ammonites. And the Arameans would not help the Ammonites anymore. Okay? So he took care of that problem. With Aram no longer helping Ammon, did David leave the Ammonites alone? Or did he address the concern that they would try to fight again? Chapter 11. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, okay, you wouldn't do a lot of battles in the winter time because it's all physical, and in the winter you're hindered by the weather conditions. Well, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, the main city of the Ammonites. But David remained in Jerusalem. In those days, the king would go out to fight battles, You even see that later, like with Alexander the Great and that kind of thing. But this time, David was getting a little settled in as being king, and it's just another battle with the Ammonites. And so he sent the army out without him. And they went, they attacked the Ammonites and conquered a few towns, but then they went and they besieged, they surrounded and wouldn't let anyone in or out of Rabbah, of the main Ammonite town. And when you besiege a town like that, whatever food and water they have inside is all they get. So when they run out of food, things become bad and then they'll give up. That's and everyone inside is scared and demoralized. So that's all part of the battle plan. So you're trying to cut off the food and water supply there. So he besieged them, and this offense, why did he take this offense? Because it was important for national defense. Okay, he wasn't trying to take over Ammon. He was trying to stop this threat. All right, going on, we now have a kind of a little interlude story here. We see that David is always doing God's will, right? He inquires of God before he goes into any battle, even if the path is obvious. So that's David his whole life, right? Well, chapter 11, verse 2. One evening, while the army was away fighting the Ammonites, right? David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of his palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. Okay, is this a sign of an obedient, faithful man? No, this is a great sin. David, he let the great power that God had given him and all the success that he's had get to his head and feel like he was above the law, above God's law, and he commits adultery. He covets this other man's wife, okay? That's one of the commandments, right? One of the great ten. And he commits adultery against this other man, okay, with his wife. This woman here is named Bathsheba, okay? Bat means daughter. Sheba means seven. So she was it says daughter of seven, so whatever that means. That's just what the name means. A couple of names here. Eliam, who was he? Her father. Well, if you turn to chapter 23 of 2 Samuel, you get this list of these great, mighty men of David. Okay? In verse 8, it says, these are the names of David's mighty men. And it goes on and tells a story about some mighty men. And then in verse 24, well, in the verses it talks about 23, there was 30 of these great fighting men. And in verse 34, Eliam, son of Ahithophel the Gilonite. Okay, so the thought is this Eliam, who was one of David's top 30, okay, the top 30, the 30 mighty men, was his personal bodyguard. And so Bathsheba was the daughter of one of his great fighting men, great 30 mighty men, his personal bodyguard. Next we have Uriah the Hittite. Well, being a Hittite means he was not a Jew. Okay. The thought is that Bathsheba was probably a Jew. Well, if you look back at chapter 23 again, the very last verse, you see Uriah the Hittite was also one of David's 30 mighty men. So Bathsheba was the daughter of and the wife of a couple of David's personal bodyguards. Okay. Or members of David's personal bodyguard force, 30 mighty men. So, how did David's abuse of power and breaking God's commands come back to haunt him? Going on, verse 5 says, the woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. So, this one act of coveting, this act of lust, results in a pregnancy. Now, if you remember back in this previous verse, it said that she had just purified herself from her uncleanness. The point of that says that she had just gone through the cleansing ritual that was prescribed for women after they finished their menstrual cycle. And the point of that is she had just gone through a menstrual cycle, meaning that she was not already pregnant. So this pregnancy was from David. This was not Uriah's child. So that's the point of that. All right, why did this news become a crisis for David? Well, if word gets out, number one, he's broken commands. He's not being obedient to God. He's not providing a very good example. He realizes that he is an example for the people. He's to serve as a model of faith to the people. Well, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10 also says that if a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. That verse is referred to with Jesus and the woman caught in adultery in that story. Well, what's the prescription? What is the punishment for David committing adultery with Uriah's wife? Death. Okay, so big problems. So what does David decide to do? Well, he tries to cover it up. So what does he do? Plan A, verse 6. So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him, "Hey, how's Joab? How's the soldiers going? How are the soldiers, and how's the war going?" Then David said to Uriah, "Go on down to your house and wash your feet." Okay, go. You know, wash your feet means to get cleaned up and take it easy. Okay. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. What's his plan? Well, his plan is, okay, she's pregnant. Well, nobody knows this but me yet. So let's get Uriah back here, have him sleep with her so that when she has this child, it's clear to him and it's clear to everyone that it's his child. There's no question about it. Okay? Nice, easy, simple plan, right? Now, a couple of notes there is that he brought Uriah back from the siege. So Uriah was there with the army at Rabbah, the Ammonite town, besieging the town. He comes back, and it says that he sent him home, said, "Go relax at home, go wash your feet," and that kind of thing. He also sends him a gift. Now, the gift, the Hebrew word used there, denotes a food gift. What you're getting, this is food from the king's table, okay, kingly food, not something that the normal people would get. What's he doing? He's sending a nice romantic dinner for Uriah and his wife to enjoy, and hopefully that will lead to something because he's been separated from his wife. Just what you would expect, natural kind of husband-wife stuff here. Well, how well did this plan work? Verse 9. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all of his master's servants and did not go down to his house. When David was told Uriah didn't go home, he asked him, "Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I would not do such a thing." Who's a more respectable person here? Who's a more honorable person here? Okay, Uriah refused to relax while the rest of the army was busy fighting. He's in town on king's business to come bring word to the king. He's not in town to go and have R&R. He's dedicated to his position. He's dedicated to his army. He's dedicated to his nation. And he refuses to go and relax. So, plan B. What's David's plan B? Verse 12. Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. Okay? If he's not going to do it out of his own volition, let's make him drunk, and then maybe he'll do it. Okay? But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat along with his master's servants. He did not go home. Even when he was drunk, he maintained his honorable position. Okay? So David tried to get him drunk so that he would go ahead and go home and take care of things. All right. Well, that didn't work. Plan C. What's plan C? Verse 14. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." Okay? Or Uriah knows that he didn't go in to sleep with his wife. But other people don't necessarily know that. So let's get rid of him. Okay? Let's make this problem go away. So he sends a note back with Uriah. Uriah is carrying his own death notice. He doesn't know it. Uriah, being the honorable person, is not going to look at this. He takes it to Joab, and the command is for him to be put in the worst part of the battle, and then for the soldiers to withdraw and let him be killed. Okay? Let's make sure he's gone. Stuff. These plans aren't working so far. We got to make sure this works. So how well does this work? Verse 16. So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite was dead. Okay, so he put him in the fiercest part of the battle, but he did not do the retracting part. That's just too much. I'm not going to do that. Okay, but he put him in the riskiest spot, and Uriah did die as David had intended. Okay, would this military defeat upset David? I mean, he lost a few men here. Going on, verse 18. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you finish giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, which is Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, the son of Gideon?'" You can look at that story back in Judges. "Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Tebez? Why did you get so close to the wall? If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Oh, by the way, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" Okay? So if he gets upset, this will calm him down. Okay? Messenger doesn't know why, but it would. So, how does David respond? Going on, the messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told David everything that Joab had said to him. The messenger said to David, "The men overpowered us and came out against us in the open, but we drove them back to the entrance to the city gate. Well, then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead." Okay? So he didn't even wait. He didn't wait to see if David was going to get upset. He went ahead and threw that in there. Okay? Going on, David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, 'Don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy it.' Say this to encourage Joab." Okay? So he obviously doesn't make his excitement of, okay, the problem's gone. Uriah's dead, so my cover-up will work. He didn't try to show his joy by saying, and instead he said, "Well, that's just part of war. You know, these kind of things happen. But we need to stay strong. We need to conquer the Ammonites. So go and destroy the city." So, how could Uriah's death help David in covering up his sin? What does he do next? When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house. She became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased Yahweh. So he married Bathsheba so that the child would look like his, okay? Maybe she just had a premature baby kind of thing would be the thought if the child was born too early. So she apparently wasn't showing yet. So he married her. Chapter 12, God's response. How does God respond? How does God confront David with the sins that he tried to cover up here? Chapter 12. Yahweh sent Nathan to David. Now this is the first time it's not the first time we see Nathan. We see Nathan back in chapter 7, that when David decides that he wants to build a temple, he goes to Nathan, the prophet, and says, "Hey, I want to build a temple." And Nathan says, "Sure, do it." But then God comes to Nathan saying, "No, you didn't ask me. You may want him to build a temple, but no." And so you've got that whole story in chapter 7. So Nathan is the prophet that kind of is the next prophet that we really see, the big prophet. We've seen another prophet before, but another prophet after Samuel. All right, so God sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, "David, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except a little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him." Now, a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. So he told him this very sad story, this very story of this evil rich man and this abusing of a poor man. Okay. Now David, hearing this story, he's king. He hears stories of problems of people and pronounces judgment and the like. How does he respond to this story? David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Okay? It's incomprehensible that someone would be so crude, so crass, so abusive of someone else. I can't conceive that someone would do something like that. That man deserves to die. He must pay four times over for what he took from that man. Well, who is that man? Well, what was Nathan telling him? He was telling him a story that kind of pointed the finger at him. How does David come to realize that? Verse 7. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites." Okay? So how did he figure out that he was that abusive rich man? Nathan flat out told him, "You are that man." Nathan made it clear, and he also made it clear that God was very upset by David's sins here. What just and severe punishment would God pronounce on David? Verse 10. "Now therefore, the sword will never depart from your house, okay, because you despised me and you took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Just as you used the sword of the Ammonites against him, the sword will always be against you. This is what the Lord says, out of your own household, not just from the enemies around, but out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives, just as you've taken Uriah's wife, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you." Okay? Not just someone who's associated with you. You didn't even know Uriah. This person will be close to you. And you lied with her in private and tried to keep this secret? Well, this one will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all of Israel. Okay? So, very strong punishment, but also deserved, right? His family would live with violence. He would be the victim of open adultery by someone close to him. We'll look at that story in a few weeks. So, did David deny Nathan's allegations, or did he ask for mercy from the sentence? Going on, verse 13. Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Okay? No excuses. No rationale. He says, "You're right. I've sinned against God. I've not just sinned against Uriah. I've not just sinned against Bathsheba. I have sinned against Yahweh." Nathan replied, "Well, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die." Okay, even though you said that the man who did this deserved to die. "But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son that's born to you will die." Okay. So David confessed. He repented his sins. Nathan offered God's forgiveness. But there were still consequences. The consequence of the child dying. So, that time came. The child is born, and the child gets sick. How does David react? How does he respond when he starts to see the results, the consequences of his sin? Verse 15. After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted and went into his house and spent the nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood up beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any of the food with them. You see, he mourned. He fasted. He fasted before God. He prayed to God day and night. His whole focus was on praying to God, asking for God to spare the life of this child. God doesn't change his mind. God had said this would be his punishment. So how does David respond then when the child actually dies? Verse 18. On the seventh day, the child died. So this was 7 days, complete week. A completeness is that big seven number. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, while the child was still living, we spoke to David, and he wouldn't listen to us. How can we tell him that the child is dead? Maybe he might do something desperate. Or David noticed that the servants were whispering among themselves, and he realized that the child was dead. Is the child dead, he asked. Yes, they replied, he's dead. Then David got up from the ground. After he washed, he put on lotions and changed his clothes. He went to the house of the Lord, and he worshipped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request, they served him food, and he ate. Just the opposite kind of reaction that they expected. They thought, gosh, look how upset he is while the child is sick. What do you think he can do if the child actually dies? And then when the child dies, we can't tell him. He might do something rash. You see how upset he's been when the child was sick. Now that he's dead, he'll really go crazy. But he does just the opposite. He gets up, he cleans up, he acts like, okay, well, that's the way it is. He goes and he worships God, he eats. What's the deal? You know, usually when someone dies, you go into mourning. How did he explain his actions to others? Verse 21. His servants asked him, why are you acting this way? When the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but now that the child is dead, you get up and eat. He answered, well, while the child was alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he's dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I'll go to him, but he won't return to me. Okay, I'll go to him being, you know, when after I'm dead, I'll go join him in heaven. Okay? So you see his perspective on this. He had been pleading with God during the time that the child was sick, but now that God's completed this, he can't change what God's done. The remaining verses here, did David have any other children through Bathsheba? 24. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he went to her and lay with her. She gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. The Lord loved him. And because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah. Okay? So we see that she had a son named Solomon, which means peace. The Hebrew word means peace there. That's kind of in response. You know, you would, one of the judgments against David is that the sword will never depart from your house in verse 10. Okay? But he has a child and he names him peace. And this child was loved by the Lord, so word came to call him Jedidiah. Nathan said, God wants to call him Jedidiah, which means loved by the Lord. By the way, okay, this was this story, when before we started talking about this story of David and Bathsheba in chapter 11, where was the army? The army was over at the Ammonites, right, besieging Rabbah. What happened there? You know, let's finish that up, and that's what we have at the end of chapter 12. Verse 26, meanwhile, Joab, so you see these just like in a movie, you know, you get these little vignettes and these little side stories here. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and captured that royal citadel. Okay, David had given the command, take the city. Joab then sent messengers to David saying, I've fought against Rabbah and I've taken its water supply. Okay, so that's one of the things when you besiege a place, you got to cut off the food and the water. Well, these towns were located where there was water, whether a river or a stream, oftentimes an underground stream would come up. Well, he had taken the water supply. Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I'll take the city and it'll be named after me. Okay, so he says, okay, David, you're usually out here fighting these battles and winning these victories, and we're at the point of victory here. So do you want the victory or do you want me to take the victory? You need to come if you want the victory. So David grabbed some other soldiers. And verse 29, David mustered the army and went to Rabbah and attacked and captured it. He took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was a talent of gold, which is 75 pounds. How can you hold that up? It's just full of gold. And it was set with precious stones, and it was placed on David's head. Okay, I'll give you a headache. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brickmaking. He did this to all the Ammonite towns. Then David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. So again, he's not trying to capture Ammon. That's forbidden by God. He's trying to bring peace. And so he brings peace by making Ammon subject to Israel. Okay? Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us. We thank you for showing us the victories that you gave David because of his faithfulness to you, in contrast to the warfare that Saul saw because of his lack of faithfulness to you. We thank you for showing us his faithfulness to you and returning those things to you and dedicating the plunder to you and giving the credit for the victories to you. We also thank you for giving us a story of David and Bathsheba, for reminding us that David, like us, was sinful. And he was tempted by Satan just as we're tempted by Satan, and he succumbed to temptation. And yet, even though he did, and he had to pay the consequences of that sin, he then, when confronted with the sin, or when he recognized his sin, he confessed, he repented, he turned from that sin, he confessed that he had been sinful to you, and you gave him your forgiveness. Just as you offer that forgiveness to us, when we sin, and when we ask for your forgiveness, we confess our sin and repent from that sin, you offer your forgiveness in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, who took that sin from us. We thank and praise you in his name. Amen.